Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for tuning in to the latest in our series of virtual meetings at a time of pandemic, which we've been running. Thanks to our members who have sent in questions for the Q&A, which will follow Daniel Wilton's talk. So I'll introduce our speaker briefly. He's well known. So I'll introduce him briefly as the National Secretary of the AWU, the Australian Workers Union. And Mr. Wilton's going to speak for us today on rebuilding Australia, seizing the chance to make things in a post-COVID world. Daniel Wilton, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. Thank you very much. I'd firstly just want to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and recognise their continuing connection to the land, waters and culture. We pay our respects to the elders past, present and emerging. Jared, thank you for inviting me to address this prestigious Sydney Institute. I've had the great honour of leading the Australian Workers Union for five of the last 135 years. Like most of my predecessors, I've proudly represented thousands of members in the Australian manufacturing sector. Unlike most of my predecessors, I've done so in an era of social media. So every time we secure a result in bargaining for our members in manufacturing, we'll share it on Facebook and on other platforms. The reaction we get is overwhelmingly positive. Most of the comments are welcoming, but I've also noticed something. There will always be someone who pops up in the comments section to say something like, classic unions driving up wages so we price ourselves out of global competition in manufacturing. You can set your watch to it. Now, as far as I can tell, these people aren't generally trolls, and they are not Liberal Party staffers with fake accounts. They seem to be real people representing sincerely held views. They are people who have internalised a consistent business lobby talking point for the last 30 years, that the decline of Australian manufacturing is inevitably because Australians cost too much. They've swallowed the idea that the very concept of well-paid blue-collar workers is fundamentally incompatible with profitable manufacturing. According to this successful manufacturing sector necessitates Chinese Foxconn sweatshop nightmares. And unless you're willing to cop that, we may as well resign ourselves to a manufacturing sector slowly dwindling to zero. Sure, a union like ours might secure some good deals for our members here and there, but they can't only be Pyrrhic victories. In fact, in the long run, we're just accelerating our long-term fate. Just a few weeks ago, in fact, I saw a champion of this view, Judah Sloan, pen an article in The Australian headlined, "Face it, it may be too late to save manufacturing." In it, Sloan correctly notes the long-term decline. There are currently about 850,000 workers in the sector, a decline of 1.7% during the past 5 years. Total employment has risen by about 12% in this time. In the 1970s, manufacturing employment represented 25% of total employment. Today, it's down to 6.6%. Sloan also observes that manufacturing jobs are generally jobs you can support a household with. That's also true. If you have a job in manufacturing, it's far more likely to be full-time than if you work in most other sectors. In fact, some 83% of all manufacturing jobs are full-time. These are the jobs my members rely on to feed their families. But they are all doomed, apparently. Now, the problem with this Sloan and Co assessment of the decline of manufacturing is that it happens to be completely at odds with the facts. Take a look around the globe and you'll see competitive manufacturing in the 21st century has very little to do with low wages. Manufacturing powerhouses like Germany, Korea, US and Japan don't rely on serf labour to outcompete China. They don't misunderstand the productivity challenge as a race to the bottom. They long stopped worrying obsessively about the cost of the inputs because they realized the main game was the value of the outputs. Their bosses don't generally fantasize about creating peasant workforces that could somehow undercut the authoritarians in China. Instead, they focused on investing in infrastructure and capital stock, encourage R&D and innovation, training the next generation, and most importantly, building more productive workplaces through collaboration that generally results in a greater share of wages to employees. As a result, these countries don't see China purely as a manufacturing competitor, they see it as a customer. And imagine that. Doesn't it feel strange to Australian ears? But it shouldn't. In some alternate reality, Australia is producing billions of dollars worth of manufactured goods for the Chinese market. In this reality, we could still have a future, but only if our politicians step up, take some responsibility and plan. We can't keep closing our eyes and putting our faith in the mystic forces of the market. It doesn't work. And the COVID crisis should have been a wake-up call we needed. The pandemic gave us a good look at the world where we couldn't buy everything on a needs basis from a global market. We got a jolting realization of how dependent we had become. So we heard a lot of big talk about a manufacturing revolution. But even in the eye of the storm, we found the political muscle we wanted to use had atrophied. Take the situation here in New South Wales back in April last year. The Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, announced what she had described as an emergency call to arms for local manufacturers. With personal protective equipment running perilously low in the state, the Premier released a tender for New South Wales company to make PPE equipment domestically. 1,800 local businesses took up the call to arms to supply masks, sanitizers, and more. Of those, several hundred were highly credible and ready to roll. And so, what happened? How many businesses won work from our government? Zero. Before they had a chance, China decided it had developed the capacity. The state government said, you beauty. And $1 billion of our taxpayer dollars was handed over to buy PPE from the CCP. $1 billion that could have been flowing into Australian businesses and Australian jobs. It seems like all these years of reflexively buying Chinese steel to build our rail lines, Chinese glass to wrap our landmark buildings, and Chinese products to fill our homes, we simply couldn't break the habit. Obviously, this is just one tiny example. Take one more. Consider the Sydney Harbour Bridge. This year, the government needed to do millions of dollars worth of maintenance and repairs. What did it use? $4 million of steel from Northern Italy, $470,000 of concrete from Malaysia, $1.2 million worth of bolts and welded products from the United States, and $380,000 in other materials from China. All of these materials could have easily been purchased from Australians, but we didn't. The story of the Harbour Bridge was not always so depressing. Indeed, when the Sydney Harbour Bridge Act was passed in 1922, it clearly required a tender to use as many materials made in New South Wales as possible. It stated, the works authorised shall, as far as practicable, be constructed of materials produced and manufactured in Australia at the date of closing of tenders. The constructing authority shall afford full opportunity to local industries to manufacture or arrange for the manufacture and supply from Australian industries or production in fair competition with imported materials. At the time, the Australian steel industry was in its infancy, but the decision to stimulate demand for homegrown products had a huge impact for generations to come. Approximately 10,500 tonnes of steel was sourced from the newly upgraded BHP Steelworks in Newcastle. The Whyalla Steelworks was then opened in 1938. And during World War II and beyond, we were ready to meet the huge global demand for Australian steel. In fact, we became one of the most efficient producers of quality steel in the world. But we only developed that capacity because the government was clearly and unashamedly proactive. So why do we lack this spirit today? Well, the answer is we don't. The overwhelming majority of us don't anyway. Last week, my uni commissioned a demographically balanced poll of 2,000 New South Wales residents. We put a range of statements to sample and gauge support. Coronavirus should serve as a wake-up call for Australia. We should be making more essential products here and be less reliant on imports from China. 82% agree. Australian governments have a role to play in building, investing and creating local industries to make Australia more self-sufficient. 90% agree. When the government builds infrastructure or invests in renewable energy, it should use Australian-made products wherever possible, even if it costs more. 81% agree. And while our politicians have seemingly forgotten about how vulnerable we felt during the peak of the pandemic uncertainty, the people certainly haven't. Two of Australia's four refineries have announced closure since COVID. It leaves us perilously close to a situation in which we can't make our own petrol and diesel. To power our trucks, our cars, our agriculture and mining equipment, we will soon be fully dependent on the fragile supply chains running through global hotspots. But the best way to sum up the reaction from our political leaders is a shrug. Well, but does anyone really care? Well, again, we fairly tested this proposition in our poll. We asked the people if they agreed with this statement. It doesn't matter if Australia has the capacity to make its own fuel or not, because we can easily import the refined fuel we need from overseas. Just 20% agreed. Even when we suggested hard action that could result in a price impact, the reaction of people was very different to their elected officials. We put this to respondents. The federal government should introduce a foreign levy, on foreign fuel imported and use the proceeds to support Australia's capacity to refine fuel here. 54% agree and just 13% disagree. So it's not the public that's lost enthusiasm for backing Australian manufacturing enterprise, it's just their representatives. Our politicians are frozen in a state of learned helplessness, mired in a mindset of passive government. Since the 1980s, a generation of decision makers living in their own conversation bubble have somehow talked themselves into a near religious belief that governments must not take a strong decision, a strong position in the national interest. That it's morally wrong to pick winners. That it would violate the sanctity of the market. They have lost the capacity to even structure deals in the national interest. And my main knock is not on conservative governments this century, it's not so much their ideology, it's that they lack the capacity to negotiate effectively with their mates in business. Sure, they might take some vague initial position of intent, but all the business sector needs to do is clear its throat and mumble something about sovereign risk, competitiveness, or free trade, and our governments fold like a cheap suit. They completely disregard the responsibility and the power that they have. And instead of leadership, what do we get? Some anonymous bean countering the public service, identifying a $1 saving from buying Chinese steel. And as a result, thousands of Australians miss out on jobs. Their employers miss out on millions of dollars in contracts. Our economy misses out on the multiplier effects of spending more and new jobs. Our treasury misses out on tax dollars. And the nation misses out on an opportunity to build our sovereign capability. It's never discussed that this apparent cost saving is an illusion when you take quality and reliability and life of product into account. The important thing is that we are respectful to the gods of the free market. No one else pays such reverence to these gods, by the way. The Norwegian government didn't bow to grumbles about sovereign risk and global competitiveness when they forced oil producers to chip in to their giant sovereign wealth fund. The US government didn't let exporters send oil and gas overseas before its domestic needs were met. The Chinese Communist Party manipulates the output of thousands of Chinese factories, literally moving global markets in their favour with a single brief edict. Funnily enough, we have no trouble industry planning when it comes to sport. When an Olympic rolls around, we set our national objectives, like finishing in the top 10 of the medal count. We pick winners and dedicate resources to areas where we have a competitive strength. We invest in R&D, engaging the best sports scientists and supporting elite athletes through the Australian Institute of Sport. When it comes to the Olympics, we don't get hung up on historic arguments about purity of global competition. In sport, Australians play to win. But when it comes to our job engineering industries, we show no such care. Maybe we should give out gold medals for manufacturing. So if we want to revitalise Australian manufacturing and the millions of quality jobs that potentially come with it, the most important thing we need to change is our fundamental focus on the outcome. Nothing else matters without that shift. But it's also a tough place to start. So let's break it down into real actions. When we do this, we see a 21st century Australian manufacturing resolution is not some pipe dream. It's a very, very achievable goal. The first and most obvious piece lies with procurement, how governments choose to spend our taxpayer dollars. Here, governments can, with a stroke of a pen, choose to have a massive and direct effect. When we build our bridges, our roads, our tunnels, our schools and hospitals, it should be done using Australian-made products. Right now, there are a huge number of major projects underway or progressing. The Sydney Gateway, Snowy Hydro, the Sydney Fish Market redevelopment, Circular Quay redevelopment, Western Sydney Airport, and the M1 motorway to Raymond Terrace. We have to be looking at every chance to build these projects with Australian steel, with Australian aluminium, with Australian glass and Australian manufactured products. The federal government obviously has to take the lead here. If we leave it to the states, we'll be left with the absurdity of Victorians building infrastructure with foreign materials because there's no incentive for them to say, let's look at New South Wales. Supporting Australian manufacturing means taking a single team approach. It means our national cabinet actually functions in the national interest. But procurement isn't the only lever the governments can pull. It could start getting serious about anti-dumping measures. Periodically, the Chinese government considers it advantageous to produce low-quality steel below cost to prop up employment in its key regions. It's also strategic. China knows it floods international markets with millions of tons of subsidised steel at prices below the cost of production. It can destroy rival domestic steel industries and go on to dominate the world steel market. We can stop China from doing this. A brutal authoritarian government has the luxury of trying long-term plays like this. But what we can do is refuse to allow that below-cost steel to be dumped on our market and undermine Australian steel industry. Of course, it's not just steel. Dumping occurs in a range of industries. But most of the time, we don't know about it or can't act because our anti-dumping commission is woefully underfunded. Anti-dumping is a lot like anti-money laundering or anti-drug running. It's a constant game of cat and mouse. The perpetrators develop more sophisticated methods. China has been disguising and distributing its products through Vietnam, for example. Our legalistic process means that the case has to be started all over again. And that's despite everyone knowing that the law breakers have become more sophisticated. We need to ensure our top cop on the beat has the resources to keep pace. Certainly our friends in the US and EU have no problem imposing dumping measures on Chinese steel. We go the other way. The Howard government decided in 2004 to become one of the only developed nations in the world to give China market economy status in exchange for a free trade deal. Based on the actions of CCP in recent times against our agriculture sector, it's a deal that isn't worth the paper it's written on. This market status isn't just a fancy word. It means we have to take China's word on a range of issues without recourse to check the numbers and behaviours ourselves. It severely hampered our capacity to deal with a surge in dumped Chinese products. We should change this. We need a nimble, agile dumping regime that gives us the opportunity to move quicker. Another step government must take to create the conditions for a manufacturing comeback is to sort our mystifying energy affordability mess. We are blessed to live in a nation with abundant energy reserves. Coal, gas, uranium, hydrogen, renewables, we have it all. Yet somehow we manage to charge our businesses the world's highest prices for power. The mismanagement of our energy wealth has been responsible for the loss of hundreds of thousands of quality jobs and has sent billions of dollars of investment overseas. Obviously, the main reason we can't seem to get 2 and 2 to add up to 4 on energy is the extreme politicisation of this issue. As a leader of a blue-collar union, I'm constantly being asked to make a choice between jobs and the environment. It's a false choice. Yes, manufacturing industries like steel, aluminium, and concrete are extremely energy intensive. And it's true that you can't run these mills or smelters or factories off renewables alone at this stage. They need to operate consistently and even when the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing. But if we want Australia to become the world's first net zero emission manufacturing superpower, then we need to hang on to the manufacturing capacity we already have and to build on it. I know there are Greens out there who would mark me down as some sort of Captain Planet supervillain for holding this position. And I understand how deindustrializing Australia might feel is the right thing to do for the environment. You could raise the Tomago aluminium smelter and plant a native forest as a bird sanctuary. You could knock down BlueScope Steel in the Illawarra and replace it with a walking track. You could shut down OI Glass in Penrith and re-establish an eco-farmers market. It would all feel great, but it wouldn't do a thing for the climate. The world would still demand aluminium, steel, and concrete. So every factory we shut down will likely see built in China, a place where green activists are giving less room to move, often literally. So blue-collar workers and their representatives have no beef with renewables. It's just that we understand we need to make the switch in a sensible way that allows manufacturing to survive and thrive. Although I have a problem with renewables, it's this. We are missing the jobs bonanza in manufacturing them. You hear a lot of airy talk about green jobs, but those who use the phrase typically have no idea what they actually are. I think they envision transforming a coal miner into a yurt cleaner for an eco retreat or something. My challenge to them is this: show me the job advert that I can show to a mining worker earning over $100,000 a year that proves there's an equivalent position for them in renewables. Let me tell you, it's not a job installing solar panels. These are low paid, insecure, and low skilled. But there is enormous employment potential in a global transition to clean energy. It's in manufacturing. So if we're going to pick winners, we absolutely should. Let's pick the renewable component manufacturing. But we need to be smart about it. At one point, the richest man in China was a photovoltaics entrepreneur who learned everything he knew about at Australian universities. Not much about photovoltaics industry here, however. He took that tech and the jobs to mainland China. And realistically, I think we probably need to accept we missed the boat there. Solar panels are being produced at such scale in other parts of the world that it's probably a fool's errand to try and play catch up. We could, however, be making turbines for wind power. But again, we have to be smarter. Currently, we have only one wind turbine manufacturer, Keppel Prince, in Portland, down in Victoria. But even they struggle to get work, despite the boom in wind farms. That's because our own governments are not holding contractors to account in the specification and design phase, or the purchasing decisions. That means no work for Aussie manufacturers. That's easy to change, but it requires governments to pay attention. The huge opportunity, however, is in battery tech. We have everything we need to be a global leader. Although batteries feel ubiquitous, the world is still trying to crack the challenge of commercial grade storage. We should be trying to crack it here. A huge proportion of the world's rare earths necessary for mass production of batteries lies under our feet. The world is crying out for these precious minerals, but Australia is faced with a choice here. We shouldn't be content with digging them up and shipping them offshore. We should be adding value to those minerals here. We have the whip hand. We can say to global industry, sure, you can have Australia's rare earths, but you have to set up operations in Australia when you go to the manufacturing stage. This is normal practice. It's exactly what we did in the past. When we identified bauxite, we didn't just simply offshore it. We said to the world, if you want to dig it up, then you'll have to also refine it and smelt it and make aluminium here. That's the kind of deal we should be making to set up a thriving Australian battery manufacturing industry. Let's not miss this historical moment the way we missed with solar panels. Now, such policies should be fairly straightforward to implement. All that is required is a modicum of political will and vision. But if the government is looking for a framework, it doesn't need to invent one. Scott Morrison could check the bottom drawer of his desk to see if he can find the Australian Jobs Act that Tony Abbott stashed there when he displaced the last Labor government. In the last months of the Gillard government, Industry and Innovation Minister Greg Combe introduced the Australian government's Industry and Innovation Statement, the purpose of which was to back Australian firms to win more work at home, supporting Australian industry to increase exports and win business abroad, and helping Australian small and medium businesses to grow and create new jobs. The point was to do something we've frankly never been very good at in Australian government, linking capability with opportunity. It set out how our capabilities, like our skills, our educated workforce, our research bodies, can be linked with opportunities like government procurement and grants and supplier access to major projects. Under the Australian Jobs Act, major projects worth $500 million or more were required by legislation to develop an Australian industry participation plan to give local industry a fair chance to win work. Projects worth more than $2 billion, which seek tariff concessions on imported materials, will be required to create an Office of Australian Industry Capability in their global corporate or procurement headquarters. They would have to identify opportunities for Australian firms to take part in their global supply chains. I'd argue those caps should be even lower to make sure we are capturing the full array of spending in Australia. And a new Australian Industry Participation Agency would work with local business to take advantage of our opportunities to work on major projects or to tap into global supply chains of international companies. The policy also included anti-dumping measures, industry innovation precincts, and providing growth opportunities and leadership development for small to medium-sized enterprises. Honestly, bring it back, ScoMo. Give it a snappier name. Call it Job Peaker or something, because you'll be cheered from the rafters. The most frustrating thing about the next Australian manufacturing revolution is how tantalisingly possible it is. Hundreds of thousands of blue-collar jobs lie within easy reach. We just need the political courage to reach out and grab them. Thank you.
Many thanks to Daniel Wharton for a challenging and interesting speech. And so we come to questions and discussion, and thanks to our members who have sent in some questions to be looked at today. Thank you.
Well done, Daniel Wharton. Thanks for that. So before we start this discussion, tell us, what is the AWU and what workers do you cover under the industrial relations system?
So the AWU is one of the oldest, it's the longest continuous running union in the country. We were founded in 1886 in Ballarat, formed by a group of shearers getting together in a pub of all places where all the best meetings happen. And from that point, essentially established what is now known as the AWU, and obviously operating right around the country. Our union is the most diverse general union in the country. We look after, particularly from manufacturing workers in heavy industry, steel, aluminium, glass, chemicals, cement. We look in terms of healthcare workers and retail workers in Queensland, all of agriculture, from salmon farmers to fruit pickers and everything in between. We look after council workers in different areas. We look after hairdressers, look after people in the racing industry, and pretty much everything in between.
So that's because under the industrial relations system, you've got coverage to cover those workers in those various diverse industries. And of course, I think in your current manifestations, you came under the various amalgamations, you took over which prominent unions came into the AWU?
Yeah, so the biggest one as part of our mergers of late was obviously with the FIA.
So the FIA is?
The Federated Ironworkers. Right, okay. And that brought in a lot of the sort of manufacturing heavy industry into the AWU. And I think at the time it was done on the basis of getting two big right-wing unions with a political alliance to come together. Not so much as neat crossover in terms of that coverage that you talked about in terms of industries and occupations, but they were two very wealthy unions and two right-wing unions, and they thought that we would form obviously a big powerhouse. What ended up happening though was two great big unions coming together and battling it out for the best part of a number of years.
So the big figures, we'll move on to your talk in a minute, the big figures in the Ironworkers Union, Laurie Short, in the AWU, who are the big historic figures?
Yeah, so the likes of, well, obviously Laurie Short is probably one of the most prominent figures in the FIA, or was the most prominent figure, and he obviously led a very big campaign to try and drive the communists out of the steel industry. And
so we're talking here about the 1940s and the 1950s?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And Laurie served as National Secretary for quite a few years. I was going to hazard a guess at about 20-odd years, but I'll happily stand corrected from the historians on that one. But he lived a huge and meaningful life and played a great role, not only in Australia, but was known globally in terms of his campaigns, and was known, obviously, as, you know, a pure sort of steel iron worker, right? And that was his motto, and he lived and breathed that for the best part of his life, and obviously tragically passing away a number of years ago.
And on the AWU side, well, the continuing AWU side, the big figures in the AWU?
Yeah, so we've obviously had the likes of Bill Ludwick, who's come through, who's known more recently to a lot of people, but the AWU's history goes right back in terms of, you know, obviously Grainlaw, Curtin, and a number of others. The AWU has had a number of members, Whitlam included, who were card-carrying members of the AWU, end up as prime ministers and other prominent leaders of the country. And we've had a very deep connection to the ALP for a long period of time. People don't understand that connection, what it means. And the AWU was formed in 1886. And in 1891, a group of shearers got together up in Barcolden and decided that they needed a political party to represent their views, and then formed what is now known as the ALP. And those shearing AWU members and us as the two have always had a very, very close relationship for a long period of time.
So you send delegates to federal and state ALP conferences?
Correct, yeah. So we are what is known as an affiliated union. And so we're a federated model, and each of our branches participate in all their local ALP activities as we do at a national level as well.
So thanks for the background. Now, in your talk, you did place specific criticism on conservatives in relation to manufacturing industry. But as you also pointed out, manufacturing has been in decline since the mid-1970s, which is close to 50 years, and that includes a long period of the Hawke government and 6 years of the Rudd-Gillard government. So add that up, that's about 2 decades out of about 5 decades. So some of this decline in manufacturing obviously took place under the Hawke government and subsequently under the Rudd and Gillard governments.
Yes, correct.
So what did the AWU do about that?
Well, it might surprise you for me to use an answer if I can't control what happened before I was born and what my predecessors did. But I'm not afraid of being critical in terms of both sides of politics, as is obviously very topical at this very point in time as we're speaking, in terms of calling out bad performance. But the reality is, we've got an opportunity right now in this COVID environment to hit reset on what has been failing over many, many decades, as you rightly put out, point out. And so today's speech and the work of our union is really about saying, let's not miss this opportunity before the vaccine rolls out and everyone thinks they're getting back to some sort of new normal life. Let's use the opportunity to make a meaningful difference and change the failures of the past.
Now, you're young, but you're not that young. I mean, you must remember the Gillard Rudd government.
I do.
And you make the point that Greg Combe comes up with this plan, Jobs, Australian Jobs Act plan.
Yep.
But that's in 2007. Labor's been in government for 6 years before that.
Yes.
So Labor's been pretty slow here too, you're saying.
Oh, as I said, Jared, I'm not walking away from the fact that things aren't ideal. There was, what we do know at the moment is manufacturing doesn't represent anywhere near the same proportion of the workforce that it used to. But what we do know is they are very good and great jobs. What we also know is we've got an abundance of the world's natural resources and we've got a huge opportunity to value add. We missed the boat in terms of building big steel, being a big steel superpower with all the iron ore reserves we had. We're doing pretty well in terms of aluminium. As our global proportion, though, we're outweighed massively by China. Looking to the future in this debate that we're staring down the barrel of in terms of future green jobs, renewable jobs, we know that the good jobs that will come out of that area is going to be in around the manufacturing parts. Because as we pointed out, that most manufacturing jobs are full-time, and right now, Australian workers are looking for good, sustainable, fair jobs, and that is what the manufacturing industry provides.
To some extent, this is not well understood. I remember very recently an ABC presenter saying that mining jobs were low paid jobs. In fact, they're very high paid jobs. Mm. And manufacturing jobs, you mentioned in your speech, around 100,000 plus. So a lot of your members are well paid.
Yeah, absolutely. We look after, and I failed to mention this before, we don't look after coal mining, but we look after every other form of mining. And so what we know is those are predominantly good jobs. We want to improve them, etc., but they are by and large over $100,000 a year jobs. Same in terms of big industry, steel and aluminium. What we know at the moment is the transition that's being purported to happen is that there's going to be all these new jobs. What we're trying to do is secure the base, because we think, particularly for the big heavy industry, that if we get the renewable settings right and we bring down cheaper energy, that's going back to what the competitive advantage was when these industries were established in Australia. They had cheap energy, that was our competitive advantage, and we lost that. If we get that back, it's going to give us an opportunity to be able to progress and to go forward. But to say to a lot of people that coal industry is going to go, simply wrong, right? What we do see is coal power generation is transitioning out. What we do see is a much longer future in terms of coal mining, for example. And the Mining and Energy Division, the CFMEU, who represent those workers, I know Tony has spoken here before, has pointed that out on many occasions. And so when people start championing coal's gone, coal's dead, then you've got huge pockets and large communities who are sitting there looking, their very existence relying upon those mining operations continuing, not seeing any real and tangible alternative, suddenly getting rather frustrated with a lack of political direction or those that don't stand up for their industries.
Well, as you know, I think 20 years ago, maybe even 15 years ago, Australia had perhaps the cheapest energy in the world. Now it's becoming some of the most expensive energy in the OECD world. Now that, you would have your own opinion on that, but that's coincided with the greater move to government subsidies of both the Coalition and the Labor Party of renewables. But now we're in a situation where your members are obviously threatened by the fact that energy prices are very high,
yes,
which makes it difficult for their employers,
yep,
particularly competing on a world market. So
yep,
what's the AWU saying about that to governments?
Yeah, so we've been actively engaging with every government across the board on these issues. What we know is that in some cases, gas prices over the last decade and a bit have tripled. What we know is electricity prices have more than doubled. And so we've got businesses who are suffering pressures that say to us, it doesn't matter how many sacrifices you could make in terms of wages and conditions. You could throw out everything you fought for decades. It's not going to give you the necessary savings to keep these facilities going. So we've been jumping up and down, banging the drum about it as loud as we possibly can to try and get some action and motivation from our political leaders. Ross Garnaut talks about the, you know, that we could become the big, the world smelter into the future, which is a great proposition to have. But what I know, and I know you know as well, is that if we lose those industries now, they're not going to come back. Mm. And so my job as a leader of the AWU is to make sure that I'm going to fight for the real jobs that exist right now, the real jobs, $100,000 a year jobs that our members live and work in, so provide food for their families, to support for their families. I'm going to do that, and at the same time make sure that those new jobs that are coming up are going to be equivalent wages and conditions, so that if, unfortunately, those industries do go, there is good and meaningful jobs to go to.
I mean, as you know, within the party that the AWU is affiliated with, within the Labor Party, you've got Joel Fitzgibbon on the one hand, you've got Mark Butler, probably Penny Wong on the other. So one's close to the green left, one's close to the old-fashioned social democratic Labor tradition. How do you work out that kind of conflict? Because what you really need to bring about what you're talking about today, you need the kind of Fitzgibbon position to prevail over the Butler position. Is this happening?
Well, it's obviously the conflicts that have been consuming the party, I think, have been well publicised, undoubtedly so. Mm. And I think as a consequence, some of the positions that were taken to previous elections have proved very unpopular. I realise this now and engage very, very regularly with our members now around polling and other initiatives to make sure that we've got a very accurate read on where they're at. And I think with some of the adjustments that's happened at a federal level more recently, getting Chris Bowen into that role will provide some alternate direction, I think, in terms of the party's focus. My view has always been, you need to be able to stand up there and say, I support gas workers, I support coal workers, but we also realise that in the future there will be some change, and so we have to find new opportunities. But instead of talking about new opportunities first and then whether or not you support those industries second, I think you've got to flip it on its head and just be unreservedly pro those industries and support them and work extremely hard to create the new jobs of the future.
Now, it doesn't matter much what I think, but my view has always been the Liberals should give their preferences to Labor ahead of the Greens. But that's unlikely to happen, I think. So whilst it doesn't happen, as you know, you've got Anthony Albanese, you've got Tanya Plibersek,
yep,
whose seats are potentially threatened not by the Liberal Party but by the Greens, which puts a lot of pressure on the leadership of the Labor Party.
Yep.
To move towards a green left position, because if they start talking about what you're talking about, they could lose their seats in inner city Sydney and perhaps even parts of inner city Melbourne, or
yep,
although Melbourne's already a green seat, but some of the,
yep,
some of the Labor seats close to the CBD of Melbourne.
Yep.
So how do you work that out whilst your leadership is based in the inner city where the Greens are strongest? Because as you know, I mean, the Greens are strongest in the areas where incomes are highest in this country now.
Yeah. Yes.
They're professional incomes. They're not working class incomes, but they're professional incomes.
Yeah. Well, I would say it's a fairly astute observation of the problem that is presented ahead of the Labor Party. Obviously, my view is there is no path to government through inner city metropolitan areas. Well, you do metropolitan areas, but not in inner city areas. There is no one can. So the path to victory is winning the hearts and mind in the outer suburbs and in those regional areas. And the bit which we've tried to reinforce, and I know some of my colleagues around the movement have tried to reinforce, is that we've got big areas, big manufacturing hubs or mines in regional areas where they are the biggest and the best job in the town. And without those, there's not much of a town. And so people have engaged in this debate. People are aware of the debate. And I feel as though everyone is going to choose an economic outcome over an environmental outcome. And that economic outcome is making sure their job remains, that they get decent pay, they've got secure work and can provide for their family. And if you tick those boxes, you will get that support. It's very difficult to do that whilst you're battling and competing with the Greens and others in the inner metropolitan areas.
You made an interesting reflection, or one of your interesting reflections was about purchasing, and you made the point, you referred to them as bureaucrats, or a lot of these decisions are made by public servants and then taken to ministers. Now, this applies at the Commonwealth level, as you know, although what you're mainly talking about are purchases of state governments, I think, essentially. So it's a question of the mindset, and I've seen it myself working in government many years ago. The mindset of the public servant is often to save a few dollars here or there, and then it's taken to a minister that's approved. So how do you break through that kind of purchasing decisions that start from the bottom and go to the minister's office rather than start from the top and go down to the departments?
Well, what you can do is, well, we've seen it work in actual fact. The New South Wales government is starting to warm towards it. The Victorian government did it with the level crossing initiatives. The federal government's got a big, big role to play because in terms of their infrastructure initiatives, they are major contributors to a lot of the big road and highway developments around that network around the country. Essentially, what you need to do is change the rules of decision-making. At the moment, the general rules of decision-making in public service is how do you demonstrate that you have saved the government money, as opposed to considering that if you paid that $1 more and you sourced it locally, what is that total value to the economy as a whole? Now, that's more difficult to measure for a public servant who can show a contract where they saved a dollar versus local use $1 more. But if you change those guidelines, you can make a material difference to the manufacturing industry right across the country.
So briefly, you mentioned Victoria and the level crossings, and you mentioned changes in New South Wales. So just give us a couple of quick examples of what you're talking about there.
Yep, so in Victoria, they did a level crossing initiative. Dear friends in Victoria still had trains running across a lot of major suburban roads of people trying to commute to and from the city every day. So what they did was essentially lift them up. That requires a huge amount of steel for those projects, and they said they were going to source 90% of that steel needs to be locally sourced, produced steel. Everyone jumped up and down. You're in breach of your world trade obligations, that there's going to be a whole lot of implications in terms of our free trade agreements, that people are going to take action against the state. How many actions took place? Zero. If you look in terms of New South Wales, the government has just approved a big spend in renewable hubs, where they're going to essentially tender out huge renewable projects plus some firm power solutions. As part of that, the government has set up a board to try and develop opportunities to source as much locally procured goods in all of that renewable spend as possible. And so they're starting to have a look at, well, what did Victoria do? What are their lessons? What's the rest of the world doing? The short of it is, we've just had lazy decision makers who haven't been bothered to have the fight and the argument. We saw it in Victoria and it worked extremely well. Just got to roll it out elsewhere.
And you think it's happened in New South Wales? Well, of course, it's a controversial decision, but the decision about the submarines in South Australia, Commonwealth government decision, certainly favours local production, if it can be achieved. I mean, that's another issue, but it certainly favours that. So you mentioned briefly the World Trade Organization rules. So from your speech, you seem to be saying that Australia shouldn't worry too much about WTO rules. Is that your position?
Oh, no, I think we take a real conservative interpretation. What I see around the rest of the world is governments being very pro-industry. Biden's just announced some initiatives, which I forget the name of, just a couple of days ago, where they're actively going to produce locally procured goods in all the government spends. Governments around the world do this every day of the week. It's just that we have a very conservative interpretation, which means we err on the side of caution. What we think should happen coming out of COVID, where supply lines were cut off, we say, let's not rely upon these global shipping lanes and overseas nations being able to produce these goods. Let's have a look in terms of how we can use our taxpayers' dollars into these projects to boost, obviously, the benefit to the total economy.
Now, you mentioned that two refineries have shut down recently or are going to shut down. So what does the government do, either the Commonwealth government, or these are located within states, of course, or state governments, do to stop a company making a decision which the company claims to be making on commercial grounds because these facilities are not sufficiently profitable to keep them going? What would a government do?
Yeah, so number one, two companies made decisions recently. One was BP, one was ExxonMobil. Those decisions were made in boardrooms outside of Australia, and it was done to maximise the profit of those businesses at the expense of local jobs. What we know is we are staring down the barrel of becoming entirely reliant as a nation to import our fuel to keep our nation going in a time of crisis. That is a precariously dangerous situation for us to be in. What should have happened and what the federal government should have done and the relevant state governments in WA and Victoria should have said, sorry BP, sorry ExxonMobil, this isn't in our interest, our national interest, that you simply close up the door to consolidate production in another part of the world to still control those ports to import your product through. Because that is what's happened. All they've done is essentially look to find a cheaper way of producing it, control the ports to import their product back through and to maximise their profits at the bowser for Australians. The government is starting to look, the federal government is saying, okay, well, how do we put in place practices to support industry? And we've been working with the Minister, Angus Taylor, on this. It's essentially to try and find some ways in giving recognition for those businesses that are keeping a refining practice here. If they keep a refining operation here, they should be rewarded for it in some form. That's the work that we're trying to do with government because, frankly, in a time of war or some other big, obviously, outbreak of some description, if we don't have the diesel to keep our mining industry going, the agriculture industry going, to power our defence forces, if we don't have our refined fuel to keep our trucks on the roads or the jet fuel to be able to keep our planes up in the sky, then what are we as a nation?
Now, it's a controversial issue, but I suppose the growing concern, which is not just Australia's concern, as you know, but of many of the nations of our region about China, probably makes this a potentially a bigger problem if China were able, I'm not saying they will, to interdict our sea lanes and our air lanes, particularly our sea lanes. So the climate might be changing a bit there.
Yeah, well, I think that's the case. And it's not trying to whip up any sort of fear and paranoia here. I mean, I think there's clearly Australia is in a very deep and protracted dispute with China. A lot of the world's shipping lanes come through the South China Sea. And frankly, after what has happened in the pandemic, our sovereign capability and our desire to be able to make crucial and essential things here, as the polling has indicated as part of my speech, is overwhelmingly supported by Australian people. If the government's latched onto this, if Scott Morrison, as our Prime Minister, grabbed hold of this, and it was more than the rhetoric of saying manufacturing is important, give me a fluoro vest and a hard hat, if they actually said, we want to actually make some meaningful change, Australian punters would absolutely love it. The research comes back time and time again that people want us to be a nation that has the capacity to make things.
Now, we've got to finish pretty soon, so I just want to ask a question about the union movement generally.
Yep.
I mean, as you know, union membership has declined dramatically, particularly in the private sector, so much in the public sector. But it doesn't mean you're any less influential because you have a right to cover workers who are members of your union or who are entitled to be members of your union, even though they're not members of your union. So,
yep.
So in other words, the authority and the influence of the trade union movement goes well beyond its actual membership base. So how much does the membership base matter beyond funding the union? Because you're still pretty influential. You're just as influential with a smaller union membership, probably, as you are with a larger union membership, since you've got coverage of whether they're members or not.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if most people realise, but there's this strange situation in the country where unions can operate on behalf of their members and then others get a free ride off the back of it, right? Business would never stand for it at all. You know, you're essentially offering a free product. It's a very strange setup and not one that's seen around the rest of the world. Yes, that does change the dynamics in terms of who we represent and what that broader audience is. The total trade union membership around the country is less than 2 million at the moment, which still makes it singly one of the largest collective groups in the country of any kind. And so, rightfully so, it gives us the ability to be able to actively represent our members' interests. And our union, the ADBU, has always been seen as a sort of right-wing conservative union. But what that actually means, in my eyes, is we're a pragmatic union that wants to get good outcomes for our members that mean businesses remain profitable, can create new jobs and keep our members in meaningful employment. That's what we want. That's what we've always strived to do. We've gone through some difficult challenges of late, but I'm confident that if we get the right settings in place, we could be a lot bigger than what we are now.
Just briefly, I mean, there also would be some workers who are covered by the awards you negotiate or the agreements you negotiate who don't want to be covered.
Correct, yeah.
That's the other side of it. So not everyone's getting a free ride. Yep. Some people are, and some people probably don't want the ride they're getting,
yep,
whether it's free or not.
Yeah, it doesn't change my point that they are still getting a free ride. Whether or not they're happy about it or not, we certainly aren't. Unfortunately, this is a weird and wonderful structure that we've got in Australian workplaces.
Yeah, it goes back to, 1901? Or 1904, it's a long time. I remember it well, yeah.
Just like yesterday.
Yeah, now, finally, you're sort of an interesting figure among the younger trade union leaders, because you don't come from a university background, do you?
No.
So tell us about your background.
So my family is involved in industrial relations and law. They've sort of always been involved in varying degrees. My dad is a judge in the Supreme Court. My mum is a trade union official. My uncle was assistant secretary of the ACTU and then headed up a union. My auntie is an official with the Forestry Division of the CFMEU. My auntie previously worked in it, my sister worked in it. We've sort of grown up as a semi sort of conservative Catholic family that have always been a big family, but we've always sort of had the interests of working people. It's what I grew up in. I spent my school holidays sitting in court listening to Dad present cases representing unions, and I committed that I would never work in industrial relations or for a union, and that worked out really well.
So your immediate, before you went to Unions New South Wales and then to the AWU, what were you doing before that?
Yeah, so before the AWU was Unions New South Wales, where I worked with John Robertson, who's a very good friend, a great leader that I enjoyed working with. And before that, I'd just finished travelling the world. I'd been working as a chef. On my dad's side of the family, the one who did not follow the same suit as everyone else was a chef, and I decided to go and work with him to earn some money when I was young, and then went overseas and blagged my way around as a chef working in various haunts throughout the UK, and was fortunate enough to meet my now wife over there. And when my visa expired, we had to find a new home. It was a choice between South Africa and Australia, and we chose here.
Your choice. You do any catering for the AWU, do you?
No, I don't have any side businesses to declare. Okay. I thoroughly enjoy it, to be honest, but this work is pretty demanding. I've been doing two jobs for the last couple of years. I'll now focus just on the national role going forward, but I thoroughly enjoy family time and want to spend a lot more time focusing on it over the next couple of years.
So two of your predecessors, who both spoke here, Paul Howes and Bill Shorten. Paul went off and made a lot of money and working in a big accountancy firm.
Still does, I think.
And still does. And Bill Shorten went off and led the Labor Party for a while. You likely to go into accounting or the Labor Party at the parliamentary level?
I don't think accounting, and I don't think politics. And the one thing I do say is never say never, because I did say I would never end up in industrial relations. So I feel a bit stupid about that. It's often pointed out by my family. But what I, to be honest, if I can play a role to support some good people going in, I think will make a meaningful difference, I will. I do have some sympathy for politicians these days, to be honest. It might sound as a strange thing, but for those of us who get up close to the process and see the work that they do and the commitment and sacrifices they make, the level of public scrutiny, which is now placed, we're essentially trying to identify saints to go and become politicians who have never had any indiscretions in their life. And frankly, I think if we're trying to strive for those people, we're going to end up with a pretty ordinary makeup in Canberra. And so I hope to try and find some good people that have had a breadth of different experiences, various educations, to go in and make a difference.
And just finally, one of our members sent in a question. I've covered some of the others before. He said that since sections of the left are supportive of the Green Left and therefore against the interests of the AWU. Why don't you start giving some of your funding to the Liberal Party as well as to the Labor Party, since the Liberal Party are probably more on your side than some sections of the Labor Party? So likely to change your financial.
Interesting question. So the objects of the union essentially means that if I was to support the Liberal Party, my time in office finishes immediately. It's quite clear in terms of our constitution and the role that our union plays in connection with the Labor Party, for better or for worse. I do actively, and to be honest with you, Jared, it's one of the life lessons after the last election, was to work pragmatically with both sides of government and not assume that there is going to be a definitive outcome at an election. And I've spent a lot of time working on them, but our heart and our resources lies with the ALP.
And I'm sorry to say, but your time here ends now. So thanks for a great speech and for this discussion.
Thanks so much for having me. Cheers, Jared.
Well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.